Sometimes I forget. I was doing a lot of things all at the same time there just a second ago. I swear I was busy. Yeah, Ray's going to be on the show to talk about the talks in Geneva today between the Americans and the Russians and on behalf of the Ukrainians. Let's see what kind of horror they can come up with there. Could be better than it is now. Could be worse. I guess we'll find out. Ray McGovern back on the show again. So, how do you like that? Pretty damn good. The best anti-torture lawyer that I know of. The best Western reporter in the Middle East. And the best anti-war former CIA analyst. All on today's episode of The Scott Horton Show. Yes, that was me shamelessly self-promoting. You can hear the shame, though, right? There's lots of shame. I'm them promoting. That's what I'm doing. These guys, they write important things that I think other people should know and so should know about. So I bring them on the show. And I know people who they can read, they just don't read. I don't like reading. Hurts my eyes. I don't like reading. I read a whole page and then I have no idea what the hell I just read. I mean, that happens to everybody, some, but to some people it happens to them so damn much that they just don't even bother. It just doesn't work. All right, well, so listen to the show. At least you'll get to hear interviews with the people who write the important things. And that's pretty good. All right. Man, and I should shut up and get to the point here. I'm still flipping through the channels trying to call up BBC or CNN or one of these, whoever wins. BBC won. I need to get to the point because with three interviews, that means I have very little time to complain about the things that I want to complain about. And man, I better make sure. Boy, I think I screwed up the timing on a lot of these. Definitely screwed up the timing on that. I have screwed up the timing on these ads. I didn't even get to it until late. Anyway, well, so the ads are going to be screwed up on the show today. I hope you guys don't mind too much. I think we got that part straightened out, didn't we? The bottom of the hour timed up, right? Yeah. Okay. That looks all right. Sanford and Son's going to play, and then that's good. That's a minute. That's a minute. Uh-oh. Yeah, no, that's right. That's a minute. And then Spaceballs. I don't know. It should be okay. It looks okay at first glance. Anyway, I guess we'll see. The ads may or may not come out at bad times throughout today's show. Just in case you care. All right, so the big deal is that everybody in American media is pretending to believe that there's this order that has gone out in eastern Ukraine among the pro-Russian secessionist factions demanding that all Jews have to register with the state and pay a $50 tax. And I'm surprised they didn't add, you know, wear a yellow Star of David on your shirt. Of course, the whole thing is a ridiculous hoax. And my wife, why, she can read Russian and she's an investigative reporter. And so she looked at the document and said, well, here's a few reasons to disbelieve it. First of all, it's so over the top, it couldn't possibly be true. Come on. It's so over the top, it's probably also from a domestic source in Ukraine because the CIA, or if it was the Russians on some kind of double extra secret double cross, they would do better than this anyway. And then the fact that the government, the local government, denied that they had anything to do with it. And I guess later they said that maybe they had distributed it, but they didn't know what they were talking about or something. But actually, that sounded like it probably wasn't true. It sounded like their original denial was more likely. What happened was some guy or some couple of guys handed these flyers out, between 3 and 5 of them, in one place, in front of one synagogue. And that was it. There's no office for them to go and register as Jews. There's no tax for them to pay. There's no paperwork behind any of this. There's no reality behind any of this. It's just a flyer printed up by anyone. And what's funny is, if you go and look at the Times of Israel, which is a pretty right-wing site, typically, I think, their headline from yesterday is pro-Russians in Donetsk. I'm saying it wrong. Sorry, I'm from Texas. Deny calling for Jews to register. And that was yesterday. But then today, oh, it's in USA Today and John Kerry says it. So there must be something behind it if John Kerry's saying it's true. I mean, what war propaganda has he gotten wrong lately that anyone can think of? Right, guys? So, the whole thing's ridiculous. Jason Ditz has a great write-up at antiwar.com. It's Mythical Jewish Registration, a Media Sensation in East Ukraine. Mythical Jew Registration in East Ukraine, a Media Sensation. Boy, yeah, the truth never stopped the American War Party and their lackeys and sock puppets in the American media from repeating things that just aren't true to people. And especially on the radio, especially on their top-of-the-hour news breaks, you know? The kind of things that, and, you know, for that matter, their little news breaks on daytime TV, too. The little sound bites that fill our lives with disinformation. Right? Even if you're not a news junkie, you're just a regular person trying to get by in the world, and there's always media on, and it's always recycling conventional wisdom, and it's always wrong, and it's always trying to lead you astray, to lead you into somehow justifying, typically, your government or their allies from doing something wrong, or to doing, wait, what was my phrase? Yeah. I'm bad with the language, but I know what I'm talking about, even if you don't, and that is that, yeah, the reason they're lying to you is to get you to support sin. That's what I'm saying. Usually you don't have to deceive people into justice and truth and righteousness. The only way to get them to do the right thing is by doing something horribly wrong, like lying them into it. That typically is the argument of a bunch of Straussian neocons. And their version of the right thing is always what we always, at least after the fact, come to agree was the wrong thing. Well, you know, the American people, it's so important that we kill Saddam Hussein and destroy Iraq and overthrow everything. The American people, they just won't go for it unless we lie to them. As Paul Wolfowitz even admitted in an interview with Vanity Fair when he was riding high on the so-called success of the war right after the fall of Baghdad. He said, well, you know, weapons of mass destruction, that was the one thing that we could get everybody to agree about for bureaucratic reasons. We could make a casus belli out of, but of course the policy was just get rid of them no matter what, you know. Same kind of thing here. Forgeries, again. I hate them hard breaks, man. I was going to say about, you know, people calling for military intervention over there and stuff. Oh, well. Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world, except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. Phone records, financial and location data, Prism, Tempora, X-Keyscore, Boundless Informant. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for offnow.org. Now, here's the deal. Due to the Snowden revelations, we have a great opportunity for a short period of time to get some real rollback of the national surveillance state. Now, they're already trying to tire us by introducing fake reforms in the Congress. And the courts, they betray their sworn oaths to the Constitution and Bill of Rights again and again, and can in no way be trusted to stop the abuses for us. We've got to do it ourselves. How? We nullify it at the state level. It's still not easy, but the Off-Now project of the 10th Amendment Center has gotten off to a great start. I mean it. There's real reason to be optimistic here. They've gotten their model legislation introduced all over the place, in state after state. I've lost count, more than a dozen. You're always wondering, yeah, but what can we do? Here's something. Something important. Something that can work if we do the work. Get started cutting off the NSA support in your state. Go to offnow.org.
All right. Sit here and listen to this thing. You know how many times I've heard this song? I don't care. I like the Slayer version better, too, but, you know, the rest of them, they'll shrink like violets if I play Slayer on the show, you know? Poor little things. So we gotta settle for the Richard Cheese version. Alright, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. Like I say, Ray McGovern's coming up, Patrick Coburn, and the other Scott Horton, too. And I'll skip on from Ukraine now, since Ray's going to be on to talk about it, and we can bring up all this stuff with him here. So, Snowden asked a question of Vladimir Putin about, are you broad-scale surveilling everybody? And then Putin said, oh, me? No, of course, in our country, we have a rule of law, and only with a judicial warrant, and blah, blah, blah. Which, you know what, any American bureaucrat would have said the same thing. It's only a lie if words mean things. But as long as words mean whatever the government wants them to mean, then nothing that they say isn't true, you know? Oh, yeah. We go to the court gives us a warrant. Oh, it's a general warrant for everyone forever. Oh, okay, yeah, that's, yeah, sort of a lie. In a way. But anyway, I don't know what Putin thinks, Snowden thinks he's accomplishing with this. It's still true that it's not his fault he's in Russia. It's Obama's fault he's in Russia. Obama stripped him of his passport. And under what authority did Obama strip him of his passport? I mean, I know there's no law or anything, but aren't they supposed to pretend that there's a law sometimes or something? It was Obama that exiled him to Siberia. But it's not like any of these lies are true, that he's over there working for the Russians, that he was working for the Russians all along. As he said to the New Yorker, then how come I went to Hong Kong? What the hell is this? And anyway, there's no reason to believe any of those lies. And yet here he is, just basically playing straight man to Vladimir Putin, setting him up to pretend that he respects the rule of law when it comes to the privacy rights of Russians. But does anybody believe that? And what's the point of that? The only real justification, I ain't saying I'm that mad at him, I don't care. You know, it ain't treason or whatever. He can do what he wants, and I'm just saying the optics of it, as all these ridiculous people with power like to say, it looks bad. Don't make Putin look good, especially right when your government is manufacturing a crisis with him and you're stuck on the other side of the line over there and everybody's accusing you of being a rat working for the Russians all along. Republicans are accusing him of that. So don't go and give him a bunch of fodder. Occasionally says some heroic stuff at a TED Talk or whatever. That's okay, man, you know. Supporting the journalists who are reporting his stories and all that, that's good. It just seems like bad PR, unless, of course, Greenwald is about to publish a story about what the NSA knows about what the Russians do. And how, oh man, they're horrible on this. And Putin was actually just, Snowden was actually just setting Putin up. Make him deny it, get the Russians all talking about it, and then blam him with some documents. But I don't think that's what's going on here. I think it would be better if Snowden would leave it at that. And go ahead and, I don't know. If he's going to make a good case for what he did and why it's important and maybe comment on some of the stories that have already been published and whatever, I guess it can be okay.
But just don't blow it, dude, because, of course, the Republicans want to make the story about him and any character flaw about him that they can come up with. They'll try to say, you know, let's talk about Edward Snowden's problems rather than Glenn Greenwald's reporting, rather than Barton Gellman's scoops that come out of these documents. And that's what's really important, is the total state. As Glenn Greenwald has said, without hyperbole, The NSA's goal is to abolish privacy from Earth. That's it. They want the whole planet. They want at least every electronic trace left by anyone, anywhere, to scoop it all up and analyze it somehow. That's their goal. He didn't say that's what they've already accomplished, but he said that is their mission, to have basically ultimate surveillance power over all of us. Forever. And that's got to be stopped. So anyway, stop making Putin look good, because the guy doesn't look very good. And, you know, don't make him, makes you look bad. Okay, good. Not that I really care. It's friendly advice. I think what Edward Snowden done is purely heroic, in taking the risks that he took and giving up the life he had and doing what he's done. You know? I mean, it's a real possibility that he could have been killed by now. You know? People kind of made fun of him for telling Barton Gellman that, hey man, you don't want to be the only one with these documents, okay? They'll kill you. And yet, the thing of it is, that those people who were laughing at Snowden, they were underestimating the value of what he had and what he was turning over. This is some big time stuff. And would the national security state have murdered Barton Gellman for having it in his hands if they thought they had a good plan to get away with it? Yeah, I think they would. I think that's a perfectly reasonable fear. And I think that I think Snowden knew the risk he was taking, that they might murder him. They might murder him before he can even get the documents into Greenwald's hands. That kind of thing. And he did it anyway. So, all respect, just advice. Okay. So listen, this is important. Politics. The damned Republicans. Here's the thing about the damned Republicans right now, is that they know that they can't win anymore, because they are only the party of bitter, old, rich right-wingers. White right-wingers. And there are a lot of white people in America, but they're not all right-wingers. And you take the ones of them that aren't with everyone who's not white, and you've got everybody else. And that doesn't mean everybody else is the Democrats, but it means everybody else is the not Republicans. And so how in the world are these blood-soaked monsters supposed to get the people that they hate to come in and support them? You know, black and brown people who they hate. How do you get them to do it? Well, their ploy, thank God. Boy, and doesn't it just feel right? Like we're way overdue for this. It's a real movement. I think it's a real right-wing movement for criminal justice reform in America. And Bernie Kerik, again, is talking about good people locked in prison for no good reason. And how his example he used the other day, he's the former police commissioner in New York who went to prison for being a mobster. And he's saying, you know, I put a lot of those people in there. I mean, that's who I was. I was a guy locking them all up. And then I was in there and I realized a lot of these people didn't deserve to be in there. He said one of the first people he met was a black man doing, I think, 30 years or something for a few grams of cocaine. Not trafficking in it, not selling it to a little kid, not trafficking, not crossing state lines, not doing nothing, just having some. And I forget if it was it 10 years or 30 years or whatever. In any case, can you imagine a decade of your life locked in a cage with some actual criminals over a little bit of possession? And, you know, in Texas, they've had some reforms. We interviewed that guy who's criminal justice from the right. I forgot the name of the organization. John Utley's friend, Nathaniel something was his name. Damn. Anyway, there's a whole kind of right-wing movement going on now for that. And I think that's really important, because if you have liberals pushing for criminal justice reform, that's good, and many are going to do that anyway, and thank God, right? But when the right-wingers are coming and they're saying, hey, listen, we're wasting money caging people unnecessarily and unfairly, and it's un-American, and it's unpatriotic, and it's un-Jesus-y, and it's un-red, white, and blue flag-y, and it's not what we really believe in, apparently. Now that it's come to this, it's time to roll this back. No, 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 this just isn't right. A prison state, military-style cops everywhere, people doing mandatory minimum sentences of decades over offenses where no one is even hurt. It's got to end. And so they're doing, you know, over at Mediaite, they had some coverage of this. They're doing symposiums and speeches and groups, and they're really trying to reach out for their own interests now, of course. They're trying to save the Republican Party. But if they can outflank the left on this, that's good for them and good for the left and good for American society. So join up. Help that pressure to vastly reform, and the drug war most of all, and the rest of criminal justice too. Oh man, I'm late. Sure hope I can make my flight.
Stand there.
Me? I am standing here.
Come here.
Okay.
Hands up, turn around.
Whoa, easy.
Into the scanner.
Ooh, what's this in your pants?
Hey, slow down. It's just my...
Hold it right there. Your wallet has tripped the metal detector. What's this? The Bill of Rights?
That's right. It's just a harmless stainless steel business card-sized copy of the Bill of Rights from SecurityEdition.com. They're for exposing the TSA as a bunch of liberty-destroying goons who've never protected anyone from anything. Sir, now give me back my wallet and get out of my way. Got a plane to catch.
Have a nice day.
Play a leading role in the security theater with the Bill of Rights Security Edition from SecurityEdition.com. It's the size of a business card, so it fits right in your wallet, and it's guaranteed to trip the metal detectors wherever the police state goes. That's SecurityEdition.com. And don't forget their great Fourth Amendment socks.
Hey guys, I got his laptop.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now. Selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And our first guest on the show today is the other Scott Horton. He is the heroic anti-torture international human rights lawyer, the former chair of the New York Bar Association's Committees on Human Rights and on International Law, professor, at least at one time or another, I can't keep track, but Columbia, Hofstra Law School, and et cetera, and on like that. He's a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine and keeps a blog called No Comment there at harpers.org/no comment. Welcome back to the show, other Scott Horton. How are you doing?
I'm doing great.
Good, good. Very happy to have you back on the show. I've been thinking about you as I've been reading the papers lately. All this new news coming out about the torture program, well, and the controversy about what's coming out about the torture program here. So first and foremost and most important, I think, would be the release to McClatchy newspapers of the findings, the 20, I guess, conclusions in the summary that were leaked again to McClatchy newspapers here from the Senate Intelligence Committee report, the summary of the report. And so I wonder what you make of these. Would you like to go through them and talk about your favorites or what you think they might have left out or this kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, this is a very, very important development because this Senate Select Committee examination is the most thorough investigation that's been done to date of the CIA's use of the so-called enhanced interrogation techniques, which what the world now is coming to accept as torture techniques. And it was done with access, full access in theory, to the CIA's files and records, a bipartisan effort. It consumed many, many years of preparation, 6,000-page report, absolutely comprehensive, and it's got both the and I think what's about to be released now, probably within the next 6 weeks, are going to be the executive summary and a series of findings and conclusions. And lo and behold, McClatchy, which has had sort of the inside track to reporting about this over the last year, has suddenly published last week the conclusions, the findings, and the recommendations. And I'd say no surprise in anything that's come out here. I mean, it's consistent with the reports that we've been seeing over the last half year. I think what's really surprising is that the opposition, which came from within the CIA, which is vigorous, is just sort of piddling out into nothing right now. I mean, they don't really even seem to be able to put together coherent arguments contradicting the report's conclusions.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's funny because all they have to do is deny it and just say the opposite of whatever it says. We did not cut Congress out of the loop. We did not cut the White House out of the loop, but they're not even really going to that effort, right?
Well, I think they've concluded that they really can't deny it. And they can't deny it because their own internal review, which was done to provide basic talking points for the director to contradict this. So as the Senate Select Committee was reaching conclusions, they did their own independent investigation based on the things that Senate Select Committee was looking at, but also their own internal interviews. And what they kept concluding over and over again was, no, actually, what the Senate Select Committee is concluding is correct. And that includes the, you know, the question of briefing, proper briefing to Congress, disclosures, the whole dialogue that went on with the Justice Department, and what they were told. And I think what we're seeing in every one of these cases is, you know, the CIA claimed that they briefed Congress about all these things, and they did have meetings with Congress, and they did talk to Congress, but they didn't fairly or completely brief Congress about what they were doing, in fact.
Well, so I wonder about that, because on one hand, it seems very likely that they went, you know, far beyond what they were given permission to do, and then in some cases didn't tell the higher-ups what it was that they had done, or didn't tell the different agencies what it was that they had done. And so it would seem like that perhaps makes them more criminally liable, right? Like when we know it's doubly confirmed now, I guess, that they were torturing before they had the memos to cover them for torturing and that kind of thing. But on the other hand, are we now acquitting the White House and the George W. Bush War Cabinet because, after all, the CIA lied to them about what they were doing? And all George Bush ever authorized was this, but the CIA did this plus that.
Well, let's pause on that for a second. You know, I think the, you know, the information we've got about them not telling Congress fully what they were doing and not telling the Department of Justice fully what they're doing, that's pretty well documented now, and it's consistent. So in both cases, they gave a sort of rosy, positive, limited description of what these techniques were. And in fact, what they were doing was, as the report says, far more brutal than what was described. So we see some consistency on those two points. That doesn't mean that they weren't telling the White House what they were doing, or giving fair reports on that point. And this, I think, may be the most explosive single point to have emerged in the course of the last couple of months, and that is that there is a large cache of documents, probably more than 900 documents, that the White House was asked to turn over to the Senate Select Committee and did not turn over. And there have been suggestions that, well, this is just sort of routine claims of executive privilege, nothing surprising there. I don't believe that. I think that there are far more substantive issues surrounding the White House turnover, and I'll just give you some examples. So if you look at John Rizzo, the general counsel to the CIA, you look at his book, which is essentially an effort to justify the use of these techniques by the CIA. He makes clear that his whole strategy for protecting his staff when they engaged in torture techniques was very simple, and that was bring the White House along. Let the White House know all about it. Let the White House approve what's being done. Give the White House after-incident briefings about what was being done. And that means here the National Security Council, which means Condoleezza Rice and Stephen Hadley, were being briefed. And in fact, in his book, he describes really specific incidents. He describes how he brought in the two people who developed the torture techniques, Mitchell and Jessen, and how he had them give a graphic description to Condoleezza Rice in her office of what was done. So, I mean, these are cases of them giving clear-cut, very strong descriptions of these brutal techniques. Same thing was definitely going on with Hadley. Now, this is the area where we don't see the paper trail. The documents are missing. And these documents would have been really important. And what would they have said at the end of the day? They would have said the White House was approving everything. And I don't just mean at the level of some policy, which they've acknowledged up to this point, but each individual case, when people were being brought in and subjected to these procedures, there was a write-up of it that went to the National Security Council, and the National Security Council was putting its chop on this, saying, yeah, okay to waterboard this guy. After the waterboarding. So all this is being decided inside the White House.
Right, but then I guess what you're saying, though, is, if I understand it right, the memo comes from the Department of Justice. So it's not just that the White House was outside of the memo when they were torturing before the memo was written. It's that they were in on it when the CIA was going beyond what that memo ever pretended to protect. If you buy the theory of the magic memo that can legalize torture.
Well, not quite that way. I mean, the Department of Justice was writing a memo that authorized general techniques. They can do X, they can do Y, they can do Z. These are the techniques that are authorized. It's not a violation of the law if they do this. This is what Jack Goldsmith then called the Golden Shield, right? But what I'm talking about are another set of documents that went from the CIA to the National Security Council and the White House, in which the White House is signing off not on general practices, but here's a guy named Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, and we want to waterboard this guy. Can we do it? And the National Security Council is saying, yes, you have the green light to go ahead and do it. And then after they do it, they're doing an after-incident report back to the White House of what they did. Mm-hmm. Okay? So the Department of Justice is not in the loop on that sort of decision, but the White House was. So there would be really quite explosive documents in the White House, which would be, I think everybody would agree, would be very embarrassing to the White House. Mm-hmm.
But you're saying because they would show that the White House was aware that the CIA was going beyond what the Justice Department ever told them they could do.
Yeah, not only aware, it was making the decision to do it.
Right. I mean, we had already read from ABC News about how John Ashcroft said, why are we doing this in the White House? History is going to look very badly on this and that kind of thing. Because the whole War Cabinet, everybody except Bush himself was there, the Vice President, the head of the CIA, State and Defense and National Security Advisor, all of them, right?
Exactly right. In fact, you put your finger on that one key incident involving Ashcroft where he's saying, you know, this isn't a smart thing because we're creating a record of our approval of all these things, and future generations will look at this and will think negatively. Well, it could well be future prosecutors will look at it and use this as Exhibit A in a prosecution somewhere. So that at least certainly theoretically is a possibility.
Mm. All right. Now, it does seem like you said that they've sort of even stopped really trying to defend themselves in a way. But, you know, they have kind of been sputtering that, well, it's inaccurate and it's unfair and it doesn't tell the whole story. And please don't tell them everything. And I guess the way I heard it stands last is that the CIA still gets to take a black magic marker even to the executive summary before it's released, not the White House, but the CIA itself gets to censor the report. So I wonder, what are they so worried about? Are they really worried about, isn't it a fact that the CIA, the military, you know, is a different story, but the CIA and their tortures, they only killed two people, right? Or is it more than that? Or
we already have a, I think you at least already have a really good understanding of what they were doing, right? So what's in here that would shock you, you think?
Well, let's take that apart step by step. First of all, yeah, does the CIA have the right to redact everything and mark it all up? Well, actually, they think they have that right. I'd say most legal scholars who look at it do not agree that they have that right. The Congress has the right to declassify, release, and publish if they wish. But the more prudent course for them is to ask the executive, is to ask the president to declassify. So they're sending this to the White House, and they're saying, look, you, President Obama, you ultimately make the decision here about what is to be redacted or not. And the president is going to look at the CIA and say, what are your issues? But then I think he and his senior staff are independently going to look at what the CIA is asking for, and I think all the signals I'm getting is that they're not likely to agree with the CIA on all the redactions that the CIA is requesting. But there are going to be some redactions. That's for sure.
Right.
And also note that the 6,000-page report itself is not being released. We're just talking about the executive summary here.
Right.
And in the background, what has got the CIA so bent out of shape here? Well, look, it's obviously not that they tortured or that they used these techniques. We know that. That's been out there for a long time. I think you put your finger on what is the really hot issue, and that is not that people got abused or got harmed, but there were homicides here, and there are many more than two homicides mm-hmm. here. And I think they're very nervous about that being disclosed, and they're nervous about the sort of accountability that goes with homicides.
Ah. Well, so we'll have to hold it right there and take this short break. And pay the bills. We'll be right back with the other Scott Horton, heroic anti-torture international human rights lawyer and contributing editor at Harper's Magazine, harpers.org, right after this.
The military-industrial complex. The disastrous rise of misplaced power.
Hey, all Scott Horton here. I'd like for you to read this book, The War State, by Michael Swanson. America's always gone to war a lot, though in older times it would disarm for a bit between each one. But in World War II, the U.S. built a military and intelligence apparatus so large, it ended up reducing the former constitutional government to an almost ceremonial role and converting our economy into an engine of destruction. In The War State, Michael Swanson does a great job telling the sordid history of the rise of this national security state, relying on important first-hand source material, but writing for you and me. Find out how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy all alternately empowered and fought to control this imperial beast, and how the USA has gotten to where it is today. Corrupt, bankrupt, soaked in blood, despised by the world. The War State by Michael Swanson. Available at Amazon.com and at Audible.com. Or just click the logo in the right-hand margin at ScottHorton.org.
We should take nothing for granted.
You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. And my guest is also Scott Horton. He's the other Scott Horton, heroic anti-torture international human rights lawyer and contributing editor at harpers.org. And we're talking about the CIA murders in the Bush torture regime there. And now, when I was talking with Jonathan Landay last week, other Scott Horton, I believe he said... at least that he thought that this guy, I'm sorry I don't know his first name, but his last name I think is Gull, who was tortured to death and I guess frozen to death at the Salt Pit torture dungeon outside of Kabul, Afghanistan, that he was one of the two that this special prosecutor Durham did a preliminary investigation into deciding whether he wanted to investigate this guy's death or not and decided not to, right? He was one of the two, but... or is he a new one altogether?
No, he is one of the he is one of the 101 cases that was referred to Durham to review.
Of homicides?
No, 101 total cases of abuse, of which there's
right,
two
right,
homicides.
Right.
right?
Yeah, yeah. But I'm just saying, because we already knew about two, but I'm saying he was one of the two that was murdered that we knew about, right? Already?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. But you're saying you suspect that there are a great many more in here, and that's
I'm aware that there are a good number of additional homicides that are linked directly to CIA incarceration, yes. And
you are aware of that, as in you're reporting that to us because you have sources that know.
That's correct. Right. And I think there's going to be quite a bit more on this in the media in the course of the next couple of months. And I think it's one thing in the SS, in the Senate Select Committee report, is they note that, the CIA misled Congress, misled the Justice Department, misled the public about the number of people who were incarcerated and what happened to those people. Mm-hmm. And they were particularly anxious to cover up cases of serious abuse and death.
And then, so I'm very interested to know what you think of the fight between the Senate Intelligence Committee and the CIA over this, because it got to the point where the CIA was referring Senate Intelligence Committee staff members to the Justice Department for a criminal investigation for hacking their poor, helpless computers. What about that?
That's a an amazing series of developments on many levels. First of all, the Senate Select Committee has been never been aggressive in dealing with the CIA. There are a couple of members who asked some probing questions. The committee as a whole has never been aggressive. It's been basically softball. And in fact, I'd say if there was a single Democratic senator that the CIA would want to have handling things, it would be Dianne Feinstein, who is their buddy and has been from the beginning. So to see relations deteriorate to the point where Dianne Feinstein is pressing issues and giving a dramatic speech like the one she gave is amazing. And, it took a lot for the CIA to provoke her into that position. And, in fact, the things the CIA did were totally outrageous, and they attempted to sabotage this entire investigation. They attempted to set up members of the staff, and they attempted to do this to undermine the report. They also dragged the Justice Department into it. And I think one of the most amazing things about this entire story is the CIA's effective manipulation of the Justice Department. That, in fact, is right at the core of the Senate Select Committee's report. They're talking at length, and I mean, there's one passage in this report, roughly 200 pages, that talks in detail about how the CIA misled and manipulated the Justice Department in order to get the memos. But it did. It's engaged in misleading the Justice Department in many other areas. And at some point, you got to ask, is the Justice Department really that stupid, or are they not, in fact, perfectly happy to do cover-up for the CIA? And I think the answer is the latter. They're happy to cover up for the CIA. And that's the reason why Robert Ettinger, the acting general counsel of the CIA, decided when he was coming down to the last round with the committee, he decided to bring in his natural ally, which was the National Security Division of the Justice Department. They're basically the CIA's outside law firm. Mm-hmm. And he tried to enlist them. Now, there's a problem with that. The problem with that is it's a fundamental violation of the Constitution, because you cannot have the executive oversee the legislature when the legislature is performing its oversight of the executive. It's just impossible. So to have the Justice Department step in and do that is a violation of constitutional limits to begin with. And that the Justice Department would ever even contemplate that request was amazing. I would say a pretty serious lapse of judgment.
Yeah. Well, and again, like you're saying, that they would do this to Dianne Feinstein. Boy. And I guess she doesn't hold grudges. They're not worried about that, or what, these guys?
I think they have to be. And you look at Rogers on the House side, who also, I'd say, hard to find a chair of the House Select Committee who has been as much of a rigorous defender of the CIA as he has been, and yet even he has been pressed to be critical of them at length. I mean, they've just gone totally off the reservation in the way they're behaving.
Yeah. Well, to be hyperbolic about it a little bit, it does sort of seem like, well, you know, come on. The Congress is sort of a ceremonial debating society kind of a thing. And the reality is, as Julian Assange put it about the NSA, that they're the ones who wear the pants in the relationship between the elected government and the actual government of the United States, the executive agencies that implement the laws. And so when it comes down to it, I mean, maybe it's a bad faux pas, but is it really inaccurate that the CIA is a bigger, more powerful force than the U.S. Senate? In reality, like, you could see why it makes sense from the point of view of the CIA's lawyer, is what I mean. That, like, well, what's she going to do about it? She's just a senator. I'm the CIA's lawyer. You know?
Well, and conversely, I mean, I think Dianne Feinstein, in the speech she gave, she said, you know, this is a death of the republic sort of issue. And that may sound melodramatic. It's absolutely correct. I mean, you know, writers about these issues, going back to people like Max Weber writing at the end of World War One. I mean, he said basically the test of whether a republic stands up in the modern age includes whether the parliament, whether Congress exercises mastery over state secrecy. If they don't do that, and if they don't perform or discharge their oversight functions, you're not a democratic form of government. That's the bottom line here.
And there was hardly a call for Brennan to have to resign. The president took Brennan's side, and then the whole thing kind of blew over, right?
He sort of did and sort of didn't. I mean, he was rather ambiguous. So he was he did not criticize Brennan. He did not criticize the CIA. He was asked several times. He blew off the questioners. And then he placed a whole series of off-the-record phone calls to leaders in the Senate and the House, particularly those who were proponents of the report, assuring them, send it on over to me, I'll declassify it, and you'll be able to publish it. So he refused to criticize Brennan, and he appeared to be backing him, but then he told Congress no, he was going to side with them at the end of the day. He's trying to walk on both sides of the line right now, and I guess the proof will be at the end of the day. Does he declassify and authorize publication, and what are the redactions? We'll just have to see how that turns out.
Right. But, yeah, I see what you mean. This may have backfired on Brennan because politically it meant Obama had to do something, so he went ahead and said, well, we'll do the declassification instead of having the CIA do it, or with the CIA, that kind of thing. Right.
Yeah, this was not a good a good week for John Brennan. That's for sure. I mean, I think he comes out of this looking pretty bad.
All right, and then so what do you make of Edward Snowden's revelations lately and the state of the law there? What do you think, for example, about the Freedom Act? Do you think that has any chance in the Senate of being passed?
I think increasingly, I mean, I really see a tide rising gradually against the government on these issues. I mean, if you look at public opinion polling from the time that Snowden left and the first disclosures occurred until today, you see a steady, gradual erosion of confidence in the U.S. government and its claims about surveillance, and a steady rise in apprehension about the national surveillance state. So that translates slowly into political pressure for changes and reforms. I would say it's certain we're going to get some changes. I would just be very much afraid of the Trojan horse. That is, we get something that looks like a reform act, but when you get deep inside of it, you find out it's not that at all. And that's what Washington is quite expert in producing.
Right, yeah. Well, if we got one good thing going for us, it's that I believe Greenwald's book is coming out here in a little while, so he must have saved some good stuff for that. Maybe that'll make a splash and have some shocking stories. They keep saying, oh, the worst is yet to come. Just you wait. So I guess we'll see, Scott. Oh, that's our bumper music. Thank you so much for coming back on the show. It's great to talk to you again.
Great, great pleasure to be with you.
All right, everybody, that is the other Scott Horton. Heroic anti-torture international human rights lawyer, contributing editor at Harper's Magazine, the oldest continuously published magazine in America. Yeah, harpers.org. And we'll be right back after this.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Edited by libertarian purist Sheldon Richman, The Future of Freedom brings you the best of our movement. Featuring articles by Richman, Jacob Hornberger, James Bovard, and many more, The Future of Freedom stands for peace and liberty and against our criminal world empire and Leviathan state. Subscribe today. It's just $25 per year for the back pocket size print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. Peace and freedom. Thank you.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And our next guest today is the great Patrick Coburn from the London Independent. He's the author of quite a few books. The latest, I believe, is Muqtada al-Sadr, The Shia Revival and the Future of Iraq. Of course, he's a Middle East correspondent for the Independent. Did I already say that? And also, they reprint a lot of what he writes at UNZ.com, U-N-Z, UNZ.com, and Counterpunch.org. Welcome back to the show, Patrick. How are you doing?
Great, thanks.
Great, great. Appreciate you joining us on the show. Okay, I think this is the latest piece, latest one I saw. Syria conflict, a shift for the fading insurgency. This is about some developments among the foreign backers who've been supporting the rebellion against Assad in Syria and its effect on the ground there. So do tell, please.
Well, I think the foreign backers of the opposition in Syria sort of climbed too far up a tree in 2012. They thought that Assad was going to go immediately. The only thing we know was where he was going to go into exile. That it was all over, and the opposition was going to take power, rather like Libya, where Gaddafi had been overthrown by rebels strongly supported by NATO. It hasn't happened. So a lot of people are worried. They're worried in Turkey. They're worried in Washington. They're worried in Riyadh. They don't know, should they support the rebels in Syria, who are the most effective of which are al-Qaeda linked or exactly the same as al-Qaeda, or should they just admit that Assad has won? So this article is about that, and the U.S. has been giving some anti-tank missiles, apparently, not very many, but some. Saudi Arabia has just dismissed its head of intelligence, Prince Bandar bin Sultan, used to be ambassador in Washington for 22 years. So there's a state of great confusion as to what the outside backers are going to do about the rebels inside Syria.
Mm. Do you think that, say, back in 2011 into 2012, that the administration perhaps believed their own nonsense about that this was just a fight between the people and their dictatorship, like in the script, and that maybe they really thought that not only would it be quick and that, you know, it was okay for them to say Assad must go because they really thought it was going to happen, but were they really not afraid at all of who was going to take power? Did it take them that long to realize that the people that they were backing and backing the Saudis and backing were ultimately the al-Qaeda in Iraq guys from the last war?
They didn't seem to have. They seem to have had a sort of naive idea, and they also had a naive idea how quickly Assad would go down. You know, there were attempts at a mediation in Damascus, and at that time, the Syrians who were not part of the government say that the U.S. ambassador was encouraging the opposition not to give an inch, not to attend negotiations on the grounds they were going to win anyway. So I think that there was a general feeling in Washington and even those and in the embassy in Damascus that Assad was finished.
Mm. So sort of it became kind of a after-the-fact justification later when they said, well, we just want them to keep fighting and we don't want anybody to win. That was because it didn't. Who they were backing, who they thought they were going to help win, didn't work out. That was Plan B. Was just let them all bleed.
Yeah, I'm not sure they even had a Plan B. You know, I think that Plan requires sort of an organized idea of what you want and how to get it. And I don't think that it was ever anything as rigorous as that.
Well, I mean, at some point, it obviously became clear to Obama that he did not want to go ahead and win the regime change himself and go down in history as the guy who put al-Qaeda in power in Damascus, right? Like, he eventually realized that this is pushing it too far, or at least the Pentagon realized it for him, apparently.
Yeah, the Pentagon, and, you know, it was obvious that popular support, Congress, popular support, the British Parliament, weren't going to go along with this.
Right, yeah.
I mean, that, you know, if the British Parliament, let's say, had voted in favor of this, would Obama have had second thoughts? Would he have given it to Congress? You know, I doubt it. And certainly, you know, the establishment in Britain was caught by surprise. Mm-hmm. That the support wasn't there. It wasn't there at popular level, and it wasn't there in the establishment either. A lot of people voting against it were very, you know, former diplomats, former generals, people who are generally by no means radical.
Yeah, I think that's an important part of that story that's usually overlooked, but you're right. I don't know how many days before it was that Obama backed down, where the parliament made Cameron back down, but certainly saved ours in that one. So now, when it comes to the TOW missiles, I think these are the same missiles that Reagan and the Israelis sold to the Ayatollah back in the 80s, right? These anti-tank missiles for use against Saddam, who we were backing in their invasion of Iran at the same time? Is that about right?
It may be, yeah. I think that, you know, that it's probably, to a degree, tokenism. The Saudis wanted to give the opposition shoulder-operated ground-to-air missiles. The U.S. wouldn't go along with that because it could see them very soon being in the hands of jihadis of Jabhat al-Nusra, the Nusra Front, which is the official representative of al-Qaeda, or its former representative, al-Qaeda in Iraq and the Levant. You know, what would Washington do when one of the first of these missiles is, you know, fired at an American airliner? So they didn't go along with that. But, you know, their dilemma is that the fighting against Assad's forces is mainly being conducted by the local franchise of al-Qaeda. So they say we shall back secular moderate factions. But, you know, where are these secular moderate factions? You know, they're sitting in hotels in Istanbul or Dubai, but they're not actually at the battlefront.
Right. They're in line at the bank right now. They'll get right back to you.
Sure, yeah. And so, you know, and it's a rather extraordinary situation that, you know, we had 9/11. Al-Qaeda was pretty small then. And, you know, then we have all this money spent, security expanded, two wars fought in Iraq and Afghanistan, and al-Qaeda-type organizations now, you know, control much of northern and eastern Syria and much of northern and western Iraq. So how come?
Yeah, I mean, they have created what they always say. It's the failed states. The lawless territory is where the terrorist groups thrive, and then they keep creating territory just like that right in the heart of Arabian civilization, Sunni Arab civilization, and they just keep
going.
Yeah,
right. I mean, you know, who runs eastern Libya now, you know? You know, again, it's al-Qaeda-type jihadis. Mm. So I think that, you know, this, it's rather strange. There isn't more recognition, I think, of the degree of failure of the so-called war on terror. You know, if it was a war on terror, then, you know, it's failed 100%.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, yeah, it seems, I mean, really, if they would just put a map up on the screen during the news and explain who's who a little bit, then it would be obvious to everyone that, assuming you have to have a forward foreign policy over there, at least one that would make sense would be backing Saddam, backing Assad, backing the Ayatollah, at least being friendly to them in exchange for them helping us keep Al-Qaeda down, since, you know, they were the ones who killed all those Americans that day. Instead, we go after, you know, Israel's preferred enemies in Iran, and we're so hell-bent on weakening them, we'll support our own enemies in Syria just to take Iran down a peg. It's madness.
No, it's complete madness, and it's failed even on its own terms, you know. Nobody's lost their job.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the thing of it is, you know, we were just talking with the other Scott Horton about the torture report and how the 20 main findings were leaked. And I saw a thing that I didn't watch, but I saw a thing that reported that none of the Sunday morning news shows last Sunday even mentioned this at all, that McClatchy newspapers had the list of the 20 conclusions of the Senate committee. It just didn't even, they just ignore it outright. I mean, that's a level of denial and complicity in American media that, you know, it ought to be a shocking example even to people who are used to this, I think, that they can just completely ignore that. And it's the same thing here, really. If they had to talk frankly about who's who at all, then it would at least be clear, if not what to do, it would at least be clear that what they're doing now is not the right thing and they need to knock it off.
Oh, yeah, I think that the media in general has been very complicit and in just not reporting these things. The Iraq is hardly reported at all now. And actually, Syria isn't reported much, so far as I can see.
All right, well, we're going to talk a little bit more about Syria, Iraq, Libya, and the whole terror war over there in the Middle East with Patrick Coburn on the other side of this break, y'all. He's right now at UNS.com, where they have his collection of five-part series on the next generation of Al-Qaeda fighters all across the Middle East, directly due to American foreign policy, of course, as we've been discussing. More like that on the other side of this short break.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here. Are you a libertarian and or peacenik? Live in North America? If you want, you can hire me to come and give a speech to your group. I'm good on the terror war and intervention, civil liberty stuff, blaming Woodrow Wilson for everything bad in the world, Iran, central banking, political realignment, and, well, you know, everything. I can teach markets to liberals and peace to the right. Just watch me. Check out scotthorton.org/speeches for some examples and email me scott@scotthorton.org for more information. See you there.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And I'm talking with Patrick Coburn from The Independent. That's independent.co.uk. And he has this five-part series about the next generation of jihadis. I guess their generations are only about 10 years long each. If we're on the third generation now, fourth generation now, there was a whole new generation rose up in Iraq. They're getting to work, and then they have a whole new generation of recruits under them, spread from Mali to Pakistan, at least, if not further. I guess if you ask the State Department, they would claim that Nigeria is part of that same axis of suicide bombers. And yet, as we've been talking about, it's American foreign policy that in the case of Iraq certainly indirectly helped them. And in the case of Syria and Libya, we're outright taking their side. And so I really hope that you guys will go and look at this. The full five-part series is available at UNS.com. Al-Qaeda's Second Act, it's called. And I guess you could talk about any part of that you want, Patrick, or you could talk about how things look on the ground in Syria as far as, or I guess not on the ground, on the map, as far as who controls how much territory. I think you talk in your most recent article about the Lebanon border, the Syria-Lebanon border being closed down by government forces. It had been kind of a lawless zone there for a while. So any of those angles you want to go is fine, and sorry for being so general in my poor question.
Sure, yeah. I think it is interesting, the situation on the ground. I mean, as you said, the government has been securing its position in the center of the country in the sort of suburbs of Damascus and Homs, so the main sort of road north to Homs and then over to the coast. But I was just looking today at some pictures of a Christian village, ancient Christian village in the mountains just outside Damascus that Jabhat al-Nusra, the al-Qaeda affiliate, had been holding. And, you know, these are the main fighting, Jabhat al-Nusra is the main fighting force of the opposition in western and northern Syria, and they'd held this Christian village, and it's quite, you know, these are the guys who are the main opponents of Assad and are strong on the ground. You look at, you know, what have they been doing? Well, you know, the Christian frescoes, they'd been sort of opening, gouging out the eyes of pictures of the Virgin Mary and of Jesus. They'd been knocking down crosses. They'd been, you know, fortunately, there weren't many Christians there left to kill, because they'd all fled. You know, but these guys had been destroying every sign of Christianity or the Christian Christians in this town. So it's no wonder that the Christian minority in Syria, as in Iraq, think their days are numbered, and so many of them have already got out of the country.
Right, yeah, it seems pretty bad. But then, you know, as we've been talking about this over the years now, you know, you've always said that there never really was a time, regardless what the White House and the Washington, D.C. might have convinced themselves, there never really was a time where the rebels had the upper hand, and they sure don't have it now, and yet it sure doesn't seem like Assad is winning this thing either. And in fact, I guess if we go back, you said this reminded you of when Lebanon went to war with itself for 15 years. So I guess,
sure, yeah.
I wonder whether you think that there's any kind of peaceful solution to this in the near or even medium term.
Well, not unless the outside powers want it to happen, which really mean sitting down with Saudi Arabia and Iran. You know, it was kind of absurd at the Geneva meeting earlier this year that Iran couldn't be there because it didn't accept that Assad was going to go. You know, why should Assad go when he controls the 14 Syrian provincial capitals? He controls 13 of them. 14th of them is controlled by an al-Qaeda type group. But why should he go? You know, but there's no question of this being settled without Iran being there. So I think that, you know, whatever they say, the U.S., everybody else, Saudi Arabia, they are prepared to let this go on. They could end it. And one way they could end it would be getting the Turks to shut the border. There's a 500-mile common border between Turkey and Syria, which is basically open for the jihadis and for the opposition rebels to move backwards and forwards.
Mm.
It's sort of like in Afghanistan. The Taliban can move back into Pakistan. And so, you know, as you just said, that means the war goes on. The government's been doing quite well in the center. And then the opposition have been attacking in Aleppo, which is pretty close to Turkey. And there's been ferocious fighting there since earlier in the month. And they've been attacking on the Mediterranean coast. But this doesn't get much reported these days because Western journalists, indeed any journalists, are likely to be kidnapped and killed by the jihadis, by the opposition. The opposition used to be cultivate the Western press, which wrote nice things about them. And then it turned out that the guys who were looking after the press weren't exactly representative, and they had to flee. They could no longer protect themselves. And Western journalists aren't in northern or western Syria anymore unless they're being kept hostage, unless they've already been taken prisoner.
And now it seems like, you know, you talked about there how they could shut the Turkish border if they wanted to. It seems like another way to say that might be that Turkey, and for that matter, Saudi Arabia and Qataris, or Qatar's involvement in this war is really all at the behest of the United States, or at the very least could be stopped with a word by the United States. It's sort of just what they call plausible deniability for NATO's policy, America's policy in Syria, which is to keep this thing going, right?
Yeah, I think that rather than see Assad win, they'll keep it going. I don't think that they think they're going to, that the opposition are going to win anymore. In fact, I don't think they want the opposition to win anymore.
But when they cry helpless and say, well, it's the Saudis that are doing it, that's not true, because if they just made a phone call and told the Saudis to knock it off, they would have to knock it off, correct or not?
Yeah, I think that's correct. Because look, the Saudi intelligence chief, Prince Bandar bin Sultan, was at the end of last year was saying rude things about President Obama. Why didn't he overthrow Assad? At the end of the day, the Saudis know their security depends on the U.S. So they don't want an intelligence chief who's on real bad terms with the U.S. So he's out of a job. It's all a bit mysterious, but that seems to be the main reason. I mean, I think the U.S. Could do it if it felt that it really was being damaged by what goes on in Syria. But I think all this sort of humanitarian bleating and we can't think how to end it is really hooey. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, when you mentioned Libya there and how that turned out, I guess we have sort of a general picture of chaos. But Nick Turse added to our understanding this week with some... a couple of pieces over there at Tom Dispatch, including one about AFRICOM training up and special forces training up the Libyan army at the Canary Islands and or in Bulgaria, I think he was saying. And it seems like that's a major mission there now to create a state where there is no longer one in Libya. What are the odds you putting on that being a success?
Well, not great, you know. It's sort of foreign intervention is always presented as, you know, bringing peace back to a country, to supporting the moderates, etc. But once you have foreign intervention, it tends to delegitimize the government, which is dependent on foreigners, because it's seen as a local proxy, and you've seen that happen in Afghanistan, in Iraq. And we'd like to see it happening in Libya. But overall, you know, you look at the area and the whole, really from Libya to Afghanistan, the political temperature is going up all the time.
Now, for all the stupidity of this, from the national interest point of view, from even a Western kind of general citizen point of view, doesn't it seem like really this is just the same cynical old game? And they figure out that, you know, really, even though September 11th was a really big one and that kind of thing, that they don't really figure that a stateless band of terrorists pose that much of a long-term threat. And they're so horrible everywhere they go that they end up making themselves not very welcome. It seems like they've decided that, you know what? Let's go ahead and support jihad. If we can use them as our shock troops and get things done, like you talk about the hate preachers fueling sectarianism, that seems like another thing where if the Americans really were concerned about this and really insisted that the Saudis made these guys knock it off, that they would. But instead, they have this giant project to use the people who are inspired by these hate preachers to go off and be their shock troops, right?
Yeah, I think there's that. I think there's also, you know, that governments like to have a threat, a credible threat that it can present to people and therefore explain their own budgets, explain restrictions on civil liberties, justify wars, justify, you know, enormous increase in security forces and security bureaucracies. And, you know, you see that with the war on terror, but it's not actually, that becomes a justification for an expansion of the power of the state in the U.S., in Britain, or in France, or wherever.
Yeah.
Actually pursuing the war to that conclusion is very much a sort of secondary consideration. I think it's a bit like the war on drugs, you know, it's sort of, you had a whole bureaucracy built up, you had a great amount of money spent. This was justified to the voters by saying they were under threat from this. But, you know, again, it's a war that was never likely to win, and the guys waging it weren't really trying to win it. Mm-hmm. I think that both are kind of a way of masking expansion of the power of the state by making people feel threatened.
Yeah, you know, from time to time, they've even talked about maybe having a drone war against terrorists in Syria. The very same ones that they haven't even finished backing yet.
It's kind of weird, because they try and draw a great line in the sand, and you see this in the newspapers and New York Times and so forth, of saying in Libya, you know, there are very few Al-Qaeda people who are actually on the line ringing up somebody in northwest Pakistan to get their orders. But there are lots of organizations that are exactly similar to Al-Qaeda. They believe in the same thing of creating an Islamic State. They believe in the subjugation of women. They operate in the same way through suicide bombing. So, you know, often there's a sort of pretense, and you see the Obama administration doing that, and Bush before him, that they're winning great victories by firing drones into some hill village in Yemen or Waziristan in Pakistan. But they're sort of defining Al-Qaeda as being a pretty tiny organization, which they're killing important officials in, you know, the deputy head of operations or something. This is a kind of fictional. And while they ignore these much larger Al-Qaeda-type organizations in Syria and Iraq and Libya and elsewhere.
Yep. Well, and it's not over yet. It's going to be like this for a long, long time to come, it looks like. And I'm sorry because we're way over time here, but thank you so much for your time again on the show, Patrick. I sure appreciate it.
No, thank you.
Everybody, that's the great Patrick Coburn. He's Middle East correspondent at The Independent, independent.co.uk. And, of course, he's the author of Muqtada, about the Shiite militia leader in Iraq, Muqtada al-Sadr. And we'll be right back with Ray McGovern right after this.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for CashIntoCoins.com. So you want to buy some Bitcoins? CashIntoCoins.com makes it fast, easy, and safe to get Bitcoins. Just deposit the money into their account at any of the major banks they support, and then just email them a picture of the receipt and your Bitcoin address, and you get your Bitcoins. Almost always the same day it clears. In a tough, competitive new market, CashIntoCoins.com has the advantage. A great system and great customer service to keep you coming back. That's CashIntoCoins.com. Just click the link in the right margin at ScottHorton.org.
All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And our next guest up today is Ray McGovern. For 27 years, he was an analyst at CIA. He ended up being Vice President George H.W. Bush's CIA advisor, morning briefer, in the 1980s. And he is co-founder of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. And he writes often at Consortium News and at his own website, which I have somewhere in the pile here, and here it is. It's RayMcGovern.com. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing?
Thank you, Scott. I'm doing really well. It's been an interesting week in the Ukraine.
Yeah, so tell us all about it. Go ahead.
Well, you know, when I heard that the head of the CIA, John Brennan, had made a secret visit to Kiev, I knew that, that the folly would continue with respect to U.S. policy. Now, it was revealed by the White House that report was correct, but of course no one has explained what John Brennan was doing, and the Russians have asked for an explanation. But here I can give it to you now, because we saw what happened, what the Ukrainian government that we installed proceeded to do after he left. Now, they wanted to make sure that they asserted their control over the Russian-leaning parts of the Ukraine, namely eastern Ukraine, because the Geneva talks were coming up on Thursday. They wanted to show that the Ukrainian army and so forth, security service, were in control. And so, no doubt at Brennan's behest, they decided to launch their army against, I don't know against exactly whom, and neither did they, against their own people, really, in the eastern Ukraine. Now, many of the soldiers that have since been captured or have defected have admitted that they didn't really know what their mission was. In any case, they were sent there, okay? And what happens? Some of the elite forces, I don't say many, a whole company of an airborne brigade defects with its weapons and its armored personnel carriers, which are perfect for urban fighting, which have these 30 caliber bullets that can pierce armor and even a anti-tank weapon on them. So six of those end up in the hands of folks in one of these cities in the east. And many of the other Ukrainian soldiers are surrounded by local inhabitants, offered bread and water, which they gratefully accepted. The whole thing was a fiasco. Yeah. There was not a shot fired until much later.
Let me clarify one point there, Ray. When you say they defected from the Ukrainian state, but to who? Just the streets?
That's just it. To the people that they were supposed to suppress, mm-hmm. and since you were real clear on that, it was the people who were occupying the government buildings in places like Donetsk and Slavyanka, mm-hmm. and others where these incidents took place.
I actually read it through BuzzFeed where they talked about how these armored personnel carriers, in one instance, I'm not sure if it's the same thing you're talking about, but where they were surrounded by just hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people saying, no, you're not going to roll down this street. We're just blocking you. And the soldiers were on their radios reporting back saying, hey, listen, you know, we can't do anything about it, and we're sure as hell not going to shoot these people. And so we're checkmated. Yeah. What do you want us to do? And in fact, he's arguing with home base. You don't see what I see. Right. I'm not following your orders. Sorry.
That's right, yeah. Request further instruction. Request different instructions. Yeah. See, they were, thankfully, they were ordered not to shoot unless shot upon. And what the Ukrainian interim government was counting on was some of these crazies from the, from the neo-Nazi folks, from the folks that have been egging on people, that somebody would take a pot shot at some Ukrainian soldiers and then they'd be off and running. That didn't happen. Now, this one incident where you're talking about 300, or maybe it was 600, I forget now, Ukrainian soldiers is surrounded. And so 13 of their vehicles are taken from them, their weapons and their bullets are taken from them, and they're bused back to their local base, okay? Their local Ukrainian armed forces base. So everyone knew that the Ukrainian armed forces weren't really worth much. Now we know that when they're sent against their own people, they're worth less than zero. In any case, Scott, what we have here is a situation where a show of force was intended and urged on, no doubt, by John Brennan, and turned out to be not only not a show of force, but a fiasco indicating that the Ukrainian government is not capable of restoring order within its own borders. And so what happens? Well, Kerry and the president get up and say, we're going to do more sanctions. There will be, as the president says, consequences. There will be consequences because we're sure that the Russians are stirring up these people, that there are Russian troops in there, there are Russian provocateurs, okay? And guess what? Before the night is over, the head of the EU, the head of the European Union's intelligence directorate, he's a Finnish commandant. He's won all kinds of plaudits and awards, not only in Finland, but from the EU. He speaks out and he says, we have no evidence that there are Russian troops in that part of the Ukraine. We have no evidence that they are inciting people to do the kinds of takeovers that they have done. What we do have evidence of is extreme dissatisfaction on the part of the local Ukrainian inhabitants there. And that's why they took over the government offices. So within 6 hours, we have the head of the EU Intelligence Directorate explicitly contradicting the president and Kerry, who keep trying to blame this all on the Russians. Now, Putin, this is kind of interesting. Putin, of course, knew that Geneva was coming up. And so he gave earlier in the morning what he called a town hall. Now, for those who are interested, you really ought to read pieces of that. It's nothing like town halls in our country. It's incredibly relaxed and incredibly non-scripted in a relative sense, although the appropriate and the expected questions are asked. So he's asked all these questions, and he says, "No, we don't. We're not involved in Ukraine with respect to these protest demonstrations. We do reserve the right to intervene if the Russian citizens or Russian speaking citizens are picked out and suppressed. We haven't done that. Yeah, I have the authority to do that, but we're not there yet. Yes, so we have reinforced our troops in Crimea." Now, how does that translate into headlines in the U.S.? Putin admits that he sent armed forces into Crimea. They don't draw the distinction between before Crimea was rejoined to Russia and after it's rejoined to Russia. There's no objection to sending Russian forces in there. Before then, I happen to believe Putin. He didn't need to send forces in there. He was allowed 25,000 forces under the agreement with Ukraine and the base there, the Sevastopol naval base and the Simferopol air bases there. So what we have here is, again, an incredible propaganda blitz by the West. We're seeing now that even Obama is throwing doubts on whether this four-partite agreement can succeed. But the bottom line for me is that after an ignominious expedition against the eastern Ukrainian people who are dissatisfied with Kiev and what happened in the putsch of 22 February, on Brennan's recommendation, they decided to launch a military expedition out that way. And what did they call it? Well, they didn't know exactly what to call it. So guess what, Scott? They called it an anti-terrorist offensive, see? So they're going to get all these people and they're going to call them terrorists. Now, Putin in his town hall today said, you know, that was a criminal expedition. You don't send your own forces against people, to suppress them, your armed forces. We don't do that. So, bottom line, it looks like we have a Denkpause, what the Germans call a pause to think. And indeed, it will be pretty fragile here unless what Putin calls these nationalists, these anti-Semites, these neo-Nazis, are put in their place, and that everybody sees, including our own neocons, everyone sees incentive to tamp down this thing and not to let it get out of hand, which for the first time 2 days ago I thought might happen, but maybe it might get out of hand. So this is good news on balance, but of course the devil will be in the details, and whether the Ukrainian faux government that we installed will be allowed to implement the things it agreed to, or whether the Victoria Nulands and the other prima donna neoconas are able to exert influence on Kerry again and put the kibosh on the agreement just reached.
Well, so I don't know. I forgot what I was going to ask you, Ray. I had a question and then I forgot. I know what it was. I was going to make a crappy joke about, well, you haven't seen the latest propaganda, the obvious forgeries that supposedly prove that the pro-Russian side are the ones that are full of the neo-Nazis, and so maybe we do need to send some arms to the new government in Kiev after all. You can see why I forgot to say that it was such a crappy joke, God, especially in practice there on the delivery. I'm sorry, now the bumper music's playing, and we got to go out and take this break. Sorry to all the advertisers who I screwed during the last break and didn't play your ads. Went over time with Patrick Coburn there. But anyway, we'll be right back with Ray McGovern and find out more about American intervention in Ukraine in just one second. Hold it right there, Ray. Sorry.
Okay. Thanks. No problem.
Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm on the line with Ray McGovern here, former CIA analyst. now a veteran intelligence professional for Sanity, and we're talking about the mess over there in Ukraine. And so now I'll go ahead and tell you, Ray, that other than the fact that it's been denied, I can also add that my wife is from Ukraine and reads Russian and also is an investigative reporter, and she took one look at this document, supposedly as reported by John Kerry and as reported by USA Today and every war party propagandist who doesn't care what's true today. This supposed order telling Jews that they have to report and pay a tax and sign up as local Jews or whatever at the down at the bureaucracy office is an obvious hoax. It's so completely ridiculously over the top, it couldn't possibly be true. And then, of course, it turns out there is no office, there is no tax, there is no anything behind this. It's apparently one guy passed out five flyers to some Jews coming out of a synagogue, and then, okay, so that got reported as a fact, but then it got blown up from there. Like, well, obviously, this is the policy of the new junta seizing power in eastern Ukraine.
Yeah, you know, Scott, I should sort of try to dust that off, but I can't. Because, you know, anti-Semitism is evil, you know? I know people who, well, Mike German, he doesn't make any secret of it anymore. He's now working for the ACLU, but he worked for the FBI as a deep cover infiltrator of hate groups, okay? And he's told me, Scott, what anti-Semitic hate groups alike, okay? And so when I'm accused, when I speak frankly about Israel's policy of being an anti-Semite, when I see this frivolous charge planted so that John Kerry can get up and play to his Jewish audience and also, you know, adduce a provocation that never existed, I get really angry. And when you're Irish, that doesn't really help. So I thought this was pretty scurrilous. It was, for me, a token of how desperate John Kerry is, since he has screwed up royally for the nth time. I mean, so who's going to take John Kerry seriously? Putin and Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, they know, and so does Obama, that Kerry lied to his teeth 35 times in one speech on the 30th of August, when he claimed, we know Bashar al-Assad was responsible for the chemical attacks near Damascus. We know. Well, you don't have to go back to Shakespeare. You know, me just think he protests too much. It was clear he didn't know. And in retrospect, it's crystal clear he didn't know. And in my view, the case has been proven that it wasn't Bashar al-Assad. It was the rebels, because they had sarin gas, and Cy Hirsch, as you know, and I hope your listeners know, has pretty much underscored the end result there, that Kerry wanted us to go to war with Syria. He said it would be, quote, an unbelievably small war, end quote. Now, put yourself in Putin's position and put yourself in Lavrov's position. Are they going to take this joker seriously?
No, man. If I'm Putin, I'm laughing my ass off at these clowns. Yeah. I'm sorry, but this has got to be a riot for him. I bet he has a little theater built where he watches the American news at night, eats popcorn, and has a riot.
Yeah, I'm waiting for him to put on one of those pastel pink ties like Kerry and imitate him. But in a more serious vein, you know, what we have here is thankfully a personal relationship of trust between Obama and Putin. How do I know that? Well, I watched what happened when Putin bailed out Obama, pulled his chestnuts out of the fire on Syria by getting the Syrians to agree to destroy their chemical weapons. That's big, okay? I also get it out of Putin's op-ed in the New York Times right about this time when he said, we have a modicum of respect here. I don't want to derail that, okay? Now, who's been trying to derail that? Well, the John Kerrys and the Victoria Nulands of this world. But very, very significantly, in Putin's press conference of I think was 4 March, he made explicit when somebody said, well, what do you think about Kerry making all these claims? He said, well, this is what Putin said. It's a virtual quote. Quote, Mr. Kerry is an important figure, but he doesn't make U.S. foreign policy. So with all due respect, we need to realize that since he doesn't make the policy, we can take that into consideration.
Ray, we're getting a lot of phone noise here.
That's a nice way of saying, I have a relationship with the president. It worked on Syria. We can make it work again. Mm-hmm. When Putin, as I said, on the 4th of March in that press conference, which really bears reading. I mean, I'll tell you about that some more if you like. But what he said was, Kerry, yeah, he's an important figure in the U.S. political scene, but he doesn't make the decisions on foreign policy. And I think we can all thank God for that.
Yeah. All right, now, so when they hold these elections, it seems like it's all important how largely they draw the districts, right? If it's one big nationwide election, then the momentum may well be with what seems like the unnatural conclusion, right? The majority choosing a strong central government, united Ukraine at all costs, whereas if they hold the election in smaller districts, then what you'll have is certain districts, you know, outright choosing either secession or certainly a strong federalism, decentralized, in the real meaning of the term federalism, decentralized system there. And so I wonder if they've decided how exactly they're doing that? I saw Yats, America's best friend Yats, that Newland talked about and made the prime minister saying, yes, we got to have this referendum, and I'm recommending that we, you know, adopt this federalist thing. It seemed like a pretty good, position. It seemed like a pretty good concession to Russia. But then again, it's all talk if what he's really calling for is just one big nationwide election that his side is much more likely, if not sure, to win. Am I right? Something around there?
Yeah. Oh, you're right, Scott. As far as I can see, the four power or the quadripartite agreement today included a provision where regional autonomy would be part of the final deal. Now, how much regional autonomy, or how that all works out with respect to the referendums and the election itself, really remains a matter to be dealt with now. The reality, as I see it, is Putin has the high cards here. He's not going to settle for tricks anymore. He keeps talking about being tricked, and he's not going to be tricked again. So I believe that he and the Ukrainians and Catherine Ashton and maybe Kerry pull along on this will figure out a way to give the kind of regional autonomy that ideally, in my view, would end up in a confederation which would be neutral, which would be pledged not to join NATO, which would be very much like Finland. You know, the example sort of strikes out, it screams out for looking at. Finland is not going to do anything untoward toward Russia, and yet it prospers. It's one of the most prosperous countries in the world. How is that? Because it can develop its own industries and its own economy, and it does so with very industrious people. The same could happen to the Ukraine as long as they do not pose a strategic threat to Russia. And the only way they pose that is if the neocons and Kerry and the other people who see advantage in trying to draw them into NATO and into the EU knock it off. One saving grace here is that the Ukrainians, even the ones in the West, are beginning to realize that this is not such a good deal for them. The austerity measures that Yatsenyuk initially said would be political suicide for him are going to be political suicide for these quasi-new leaders that are in Kiev, because they require real austerity on the part of the Ukrainians, the Ukrainian manufacturing sector now because of devaluation of their currency, are having trouble paying for the Russian goods that they get and vice versa. So economic hardship is going to hit home as it did in Greece. And I was in Greece four summers ago, and I saw the general strikes, and I saw how the workers rose up and really tried to do what they could against the austerity measures and couldn't do much. Ukrainians are likely to do that in spades. So that's another aspect here. As it dawns on the Ukrainians that they're going to have to pay twice what they used to pay for natural gas to heat and so forth, then there's going to be a realization that, well, you know, even in the Western Ukraine, this wasn't such a good idea. And again, you don't get that from the Western press, Scott. What you get from the Western press is, quote, Russia has said it would double the price of natural gas for the Ukraine.
Yeah.
Well, it didn't say that at all. What Russia said was, we're going to go back to the regular price.
Yeah, we're going to stop selling it at half price.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, exactly. These people, these are the same people call every tax cut a subsidy. We know how they are. But now, so let me ask you about this. Come on, you're a former CIA analyst, and I know as well as you do, and I agree with you, that clearly America picked this fight and pushed it way too far and all this stuff. But what about Putin's ambition? Wouldn't he like to take back Little Russia? He called eastern Ukraine Little Russia the other day, and people freaked out. You know, this guy is a mean old right-wing Russian Republican, ain't he? Wouldn't he take advantage if he could? Ray, what's up?
Well, I think he takes advantage of the situation simply by sitting back, realizing that he has the high cards, writing to 28 nations that depend on Russian gas and oil, and saying, look, you know, we can sell this at market prices now. The Ukrainians can siphon this thing off. Don't you guys realize that I have the high cards here? He doesn't need to. And he said this explicitly. He doesn't need to do anymore. Russia has enough influence on Ukraine now. It's a miracle that Nuland and the rest of them went after the government the way they did. It's not such a miracle because their underlying effort there was to cause as much enmity between Putin and Obama as they possibly could. And they succeeded in that. They overreached in the Ukraine, but at least it's going to be several months now before Putin and Obama can overtly start to create detente again. So what I'm saying here is that, in my view, Putin doesn't need to do it. He doesn't. Why would he want to take on the Ukraine when the West has just pledged $28 billion to bail him out? He's got the high cards. If he has 40,000 troops on the border, well, that's his right to have 40,000 troops on the border. He's not going to invade that part of the Ukraine. So what I see is Western propaganda mills making this case, but it's a lame excuse for their overreach. And all I see is that Putin says, well, you know, we're going to end up with as much influence in Ukraine as we need, just as we had before. And meanwhile, you know, sort of by accident, we've been given that John Kerry and his neocons a really bloody nose.
Yeah. Which they showed up looking like that in the first place. So, all right.
Well, you know, the president looks really feckless, too.
I'm sorry?
The president. The president, you know, somebody tells him to threaten consequences. Well, who's going to take, you know, visualize a situation where the President of the United States needs to really and truly threaten consequences, okay, on a national security matter. Who's going to take him seriously?
Yeah. No, I'd rather have a completely lame duck. I'd rather have Bush at 30% approval or Obama at wherever he's at now, where everybody, the consensus is that he's pathetic and nobody needs to listen to him here or there. That's my favorite kind of president.
Well, you know, except for...
Especially Obama. He backs down all the time. And 9 times out of 10, I agree with him backing down from whatever stupid thing he was going to do.
You know? Yeah, that's a heck of a thing to say, isn't it? Yeah, well, what I would say is that to the degree that he has this relationship with Putin, and to the degree that can tamp down things in Syria and help things with respect to Iran. And that relationship is worth keeping. I frankly am surprised at how much backbone, and I never thought I would use backbone in the same sentence with Obama, but he has shown backbone on Iran, and he needs the Russians to continue to help him on that. And finally, I think we're going to be able to say to the Iranians, look, we want you to stop working on that nuclear weapon that we know that you stopped working on 11 years ago. And the Iranians are going to say, okay. And as I see from the latest reports, they've already agreed to degrade some of their 20% enriched uranium back down to the 3.5% percent that they need to power their electrical generating reactors. So I see progress there, and I could see incentive on the part of Israel and some others to derail that progress. And as long as Obama can have some modicum of relationship of trust with Putin, I think he can face them down and get rid of this needless irritant and start working on other things in the Middle East.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, man, if this Ukraine thing ruins the Iran nuclear deal, I'm going to be angry, and especially considering, like you're saying, and I guess this was your colleague Robert Perry's theory for the whole problem in the first place, was that the neoconservatives, Robert Kagan and his wife Victoria Nuland, that they seemingly had cooked this thing up just to drive a wedge between America and Russia before the final Iran nuclear deal is signed and implemented, and to see if they can, because that's, of course, their, you know, number one concern is the Likud party's foreign policy for Israel.
Yeah. And, you know, as I watch some of the crazier things that are happening, you know, one wonders about the sanity of Kerry. I noticed that TOW weapons, which are anti-tank weapons of considerable power, that they've been made available to the Syrian rebels now. And that's just so mischievous. You know, those are American-made weapons. There are all kinds of laws that prevent them from being transferred to people like the rebels, some of whom are al-Qaeda. And the fact that they're going into Syria now tells me only this, that is, that Bashar al-Assad has begun to wipe Syria free of most of the rebels, and there is incentive on the part, first of all, of Israel to keep that terrible situation going in Syria, where Shiites and Sunnis are at each other's throats. One senior Israeli official, when asked what Israel's preferred outcome is in Syria, he said without blinking an eye, well, our preferred outcome is no outcome. And the follow-up question was, what do you mean no outcome? And he said precisely that. As long as the Shia and Sunnis are fighting each other, not only in Syria, mind you, but in the rest of the whole area, that part of the Middle East, they're not going to be trading their guns on us, and so let them kill each other off. Now, that's one heck of an attitude, but I'm convinced that they spoke with unusual candor, and as long as they can keep the pot boiling in Syria, and these TOW weapons are going to help achieve that, and then this unconscionable carnage that has happened for the last 3 years will continue. And all the more reason, where we need sane adult people like Putin certainly is, and like I believe Obama can be in his better moments, to make sure that that doesn't get still worse.
Yeah. Well, I know, too, that's the problem, is it's so little reported what's really going on. Compared even to the embedded kooks from the Iraq war putting out the government line, there was still, you know, some context you could glean from all that stuff. But the news coming out of Syria is really doesn't come out in near as much quantity to really get the picture across. But it's a real nightmare over there. And if the Americans, if they meant at all what they ever say about how much they care about peace and freedom and justice and all this crap at all. Their first priority would be resolving this thing, not helping one side win or the other, but calling some kind of truce, figuring out how to do it. At the very least, tell the Saudis to stop giving them the TOW missiles that we gave them. I mean, come on.
Yeah. Whether it's the Saudis or the Turks, or that's what makes Syria so complicated. You got the Saudis, you know, our, quote, best friends, end quote. You got the Turks. You got the Israelis. You got everybody kind of enmeshed in this thing, taking advantage of what 3 years ago started as a popular uprising of the nature of the Arab Spring. Now, once they so cynically took hold there, once Prince Bandar decided to send the worst guys into Syria to exploit this thing, then, you know, our incentive was kind of complicated, because we don't want to cross Prince Bandar, you know, and we don't want to cross the Turks. What we should have said, and what we would have said if we had a State Department that was worth its name, was, look, this is a humanitarian crisis. What we need to do is cooperate with everyone, including the Russians, to tamp this thing down. And instead, because largely the Israelis wanted to keep the pot boiling, the pot has been overflowing for the last 3 years, and that is really a tragedy for the Syrian people.
Yeah. All right, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for your time, Ray. I sure appreciate it.
You're welcome. Take care now.
All right, everybody. That is the great Ray McGovern. RayMcGovern.com. Also, ConsortiumNews.com, a former CIA analyst for 27 years, and, of course, co-founder of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. And that's it for the show. Thanks for listening. See y'all tomorrow.